Dusty. This is Mr. Robert R. Gilruth.
Gilruth. Mr. Chairman, it's a great privilege and honor to be here. I know you want to hear from the men that have actually flown in space. I would just have one suggestion here. I would like to ask Gus Grissom to discuss one phase of the program that has received relatively little cover, and yet it's been a very vital and important part of it. And that has to do with the very extensive training that has been done and the various novel devices that have been used by the seven astronauts to get as fit and as ready and as experienced as was humanly possible to get them on ground-based equipment before the actual rides into space. Gus, would you take over and run down that program briefly?
Come on, John. All three of you come up close where you can talk to the mic. Now come in as close as you can.
Well, Mr. Chairman, a lot has been said about our training program in the past. And while it's true it has been a long training program, some 3 years, and at times it's been quite difficult. But the three of us have found from our flight experience that it has trained us well. It has been an adequate program. And in our discussions, we can't really think of anything that we have admitted or really anything that we have had too much of. For instance, on the centrifuge program that we run at Johnsville, Pennsylvania, we undergo launch accelerations and reentry accelerations. And to a certain extent, we overtrain here a little bit in that we have taken accelerations up to 16 Gs. We're on a normal launch and reentry. We don't expect to run into anything more than about 8 Gs, or as the flight that Al and I took on the Redstone, we took about 11 Gs on reentry. So we are well prepared for those accelerations. We also have flight simulators, both at Langley Space Task Group and at the at Cape Canaveral, where we train ourselves in the flight program and in controlling the capsule and in emergency procedures. They are used to train the ground personnel also. It's used in conjunction with our worldwide range to train systems monitors and capsule communicators and people all around the world. The astronaut actually gets in the simulator and is in contact with these people in the building, and at times even people as far away as Australia. One of the other, I can't go through all the training programs we've had, but one that was especially important to me was some of the recovery work that we did. A good deal of it was done at Pensacola, one of the naval stations. And this was concerned with getting out of the capsule in the water and learning to take care of ourselves in the water. And as you know, my capsule, Liberty Bell 7, was lost, and without this training, I'm fairly certain I wouldn't be here today talking to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Captain. I was tremendously interested in that last statement. Do you care to elaborate on it from the standpoint of how much above minimum you had that enabled you to come out of there, I believe you said, with no worse damage than a mouthful of salt water?
Well, I guess I was a little I wasn't really concerned initially when the door blew off the capsule and I came out into the water. I felt I was in good shape and no problem, but we have a neck dam around the top of the suit that was leaking some air, and the suit is quite heavy. And so before I was actually picked up, I was getting a little exhausted holding both myself and the suit up. But I still had plenty of reserve. I could have lasted quite a while.
Thank you. Mr. Webb, was that...
These men are at the disposal of the committee, Mr. Chairman. If either one of them has a statement to make, I'm sure the committee would be glad to hear it, or you can proceed.
Commander Shepard, do you have a statement you want to make?
Just a few words. Mr. Chairman, I think that I know I would like to say that we're happy to be here today as we were before the House committee yesterday. And because of the nature of the occasion today, we don't have any prepared testimony or presentation. We will be happy to answer any questions which the committee may have. And also because of the confused nature of this week, we don't have too much time.
The confused nature of what?
Of this week.
Oh.
Because of our... because of the pace of our activities.
Mr. Chairman, I think the President spoke of as being almost greater than space flight.
I think Mr. Webb has made it clear, but let me reiterate that we would be happy to come to Washington and testify or answer any questions that the committee may have at any time regarding our program. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Commander. Colonel Glenn, do you have a word before we start the questions?
No, I think Val stated it very well. We're here to be at your disposal, sir, to help you as we may.
Fine. In your great message to the Congress the other day, Colonel, you referred to your flight in Friendship 7, quote, as just the beginning, and, quote, the building blocks. What would you say was the most important discovery you personally made on this flight?
Mr. Chairman, I think probably there were... we might generalize a moment on the two major things. I think they're mainly in a philosophical field as far as future design concepts go. I think we proved on this flight that the man can operate in this new and completely strange environment, can operate satisfactorily. I think that in the future we will probably be able to maybe put less automation into some of our machines than was included in the Project Mercury design. This was necessary in the Project Mercury design. We didn't dispute that with the other engineers and scientists that were working on the project. Because on this first time out, we did want to make sure we got the man back if we, in fact, found out that the man was not capable of operating in this new environment for a period of time. But I think in the future, we probably can do with... we can plug man into the system here, make him a part of the system that we rely on to take intelligent action while he's in space, and thus get by with a lot less automation, maybe, than we have in the past.
Tell us, in your judgment, what you found out and what NASA found out by reason of the fact that you were in this capsule and manually operated it a portion of the time that could not have been learned without you or another efficient astronaut being in it, acting in that capacity. In other words, what did you find out that it required a man being there to find out?
Well, we found the main thing, of course, was when we ran into trouble with the automatic stabilization and control system, where with just the capsule without a man aboard, we would probably have had to end the mission right there or bring it back in early. Or there might have been some question about whether we could even have gotten it back or not. At that point, I was capable of taking over, controlling the capsule, controlling the attitude of the capsule, and making what I hope were intelligent decisions with regard to bringing it back in coordination with the people on the ground. This certainly would have been impossible had man not been aboard.
Could I add something to that, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Commander.
I just thought of something which... which John has not covered in the past few days, I think which very definitely indicates that we learned something on this flight. There's been question for some time as to how visible would stars be during daylight. And I think extrapolating this little bit of information ahead, we intend to use the old method which seamen have used for years on the way to the moon. That is, using the stars to provide a fix, to provide a location, navigation aid. And I think John's observation of the stars during his flight, during the daylight hours, indicates that we indeed have the possibility to use this method for space navigation. This particular point has not been brought out, so I thought you might be interested in that observation.
Thank you, Commander.
If I might continue, just one
other word,
Mr. Chairman. A lot of these things we may be a little bit vague on at the moment because we have had practically no opportunity to go over any of the results from the flight ourselves. Data are being worked out now at Cape Canaveral, and I expect to go back there very shortly to get back to work again, I hope. There are many, many things that I think will be coming out in the next few weeks as results of the flight from review of the onboard tape recordings and the cameras on board that recorded both a view of the instrument panel and a view of me during the flight. So these are really general views that we're giving you now, and I'm sure we'll have more specific data later if you would care to have us come back sometime at a later date.
Well, I assume then from your answer that you're telling us that we will make greater progress, achieve our objectives sooner, do it with more efficiency and greater value with a manned spacecraft than with just the spacecraft in orbit controlled mechanically from the ground.
I'm sorry I didn't put it in those words myself, sir.
Senator Smith, you take that as a compliment. Yes. What training, Colonel, would you recommend to young Americans who would like to have some direct part in this new space age, whether they want to be astronauts or in the program backing them up?
Yes, I feel very strongly, Mr. Chairman, that this is one of the finest byproducts of the whole program, really, is the inspiration maybe to greater effort in these fields that we can pass on to the people who will come along after us, those who are in their education years right now. And I think that really is the crux of the whole thing. If we expect to stay in a position of leadership in this field, we need trained people very much. Whether they go into training directly as astronauts, as we have done, or whether they are in all the many supporting fields, or whether they are in a differing science field in general, a basic, good, sound education is a prerequisite to any progress in this field. My best advice to anyone starting out in this field, as we have given many times in letters to people writing into us, is just to get the finest, basic, good, general education they can. Let their own talents then, beyond that point, guide them into what particular area they should be in. But I think a good, sound, basic education is certainly a prerequisite to any activity in this field.
Thank you very much, Colonel. If I have time when the other senators have asked you a question, I'll have one more, but at this time I'll call on Senator Anderson.
Well, I was going to suggest, Mr. Chairman, that a lot of people in the back of the room that haven't had a very good look at them, would you mind if I used a minute of my time to ask Colonel Glenn to turn around and face the back of the room and smile at the people?
Also, Shepard and Grissom.
Senator, I suggest Mr. Gilruth, who's been the manager of the project.
I was coming to that. Well, thank you. I want to assure you, Commander Shepard and Captain Grissom, that I was going to suggest individually that you folks do the same thing, but as long as you all did it together. Yes, Colonel.
Gus was a little embarrassed to do this, but I'll take care of it here. As he turned around, Gus saw his sister sitting back here.
Well, let her stand up.
Why don't we have her stand up?
Let her stand up.
And Senator Anderson, the wives of our astronauts are here. Maybe Senator Curry would yield you 1 minute to let them stand up.
We'd like to have their wives stand.
Mrs. Shepard, Mrs. Grissom, and Mrs. Gilruth. Mrs. Gilruth.
Is there any home looking after children?
Well, my wife's at home getting the kids in school today.
She's entitled to that vacation. Well, thank you very much, because I realize these people were very, very anxious, as all America is, to see you. You spoke of the training program, and Captain Grissom told how essential it was that this be done. A great many people are saying, if you don't allow these men to go back up again, is there anybody that can get in the spacecraft other than their backups, the rest of the astronauts? Aren't there literally hundreds and thousands of young Americans who could be taught this? In other words, is our program hampered by only a few men being able to fly a spaceship? Colonel, what would you say?
Well, obviously there are many, many people that could be trained to do this job. Mm-hmm. Starting out on a new project like this, when the ground rules were set up for the type people they wanted, they felt that military test pilots probably had the best background to be sort of a take-charge type person, I guess, in case of an emergency or in case of difficulty on the spacecraft. These were the people who were used to being all different kinds of G-fields and tolerances, used to using oxygen and masks and so many different things that went into their backgrounds. They were used to coping with emergencies. This was the type person they looked for on these early programs. I think this was a valid selection criteria. I think it will probably remain so, at least for the immediate future. Mm-hmm. When we get to boosters of sufficient size where we can have the luxury of more people aboard, when we get to that point, then perhaps there will be a reason for making people of other disciplines also members of the crew. But at least for the immediate time period we're talking about, we feel at the moment that the same type people should be selected for future programs. In the numbers of people that you mentioned, though, I think it's surprising if you figure up all the missions that we can possibly lay on in the next 10 years, the crew requirements don't get too big. We don't envision any crew training program of thousands of astronauts, for instance. I'm afraid we'd all be bankrupt if we tried that.
Well, I appreciate that answer, because there were some people who worried that the program might be held back because there weren't sufficient astronauts to carry it on.
No, sir.
Yes, Captain.
Well, Senator Anderson, I think you stated that the three of us wouldn't be permitted to make other flights. No one has told me this, and
I have... I didn't say that. Okay. I said if.
I want to make sure this wasn't your impression.
No, I merely said if you weren't, because some people say, well, we must not rob our country of their experience, must let them go up again. I imagine you're anxious to go, and we're anxious to have you, at least I am. But if that was, this is not one of the things that will hold back the program. Now, you mentioned the fact that man could control. If you remove from the capsule some of the automatic controls, knowing that, would you have space and weight limitations to allow two men to go, for example, with pretty much the same equipment you now have, leaving out automation from it? If you can cut out some of the automatic control. Either one of you, yes. Well, suppose we start with Commander Shepherd.
The answer to that question with respect to our present capsule is that if we removed some of the automatic equipment, which, as a matter of fact, we intend to do, we are taking steps already for some of our Mercury capsules to be launched later, toward the end of this year or earlier next year, to remove some of this automatic equipment. Generally speaking, it would provide us with the weight capability to put an extra man in there, but there is not, at the moment, additional space, to coin a word. The follow-on program, which Mr. Webb and his team are presenting in these appropriations hearings, called Gemini, has been designed to carry two people from the start. The capsule is larger and provides that capability.
Would it be perhaps free from some of the automation?
I'm sorry,
would you be able to take out some of the automatic controls?
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. This thesis, then, will be included in our design concepts as we go on in future designs.
When the two-man craft goes up, would you like to be on it?
Me?
Yes.
Very definitely.
And you, Captain?
Yes, sir.
Colonel, I assume you would also.
They told me to say yes. I didn't hear the question.
Well, this would not be the first time that a witness was coached before a congressional committee. Mr. Chairman, I don't think I have additional questions. I know that we're all anxious to give all the members of the committee a chance to ask questions, and I know that we all deeply appreciate the fact that you're here, and the fact that we don't all ask you a great many questions is only evidence of our joy in having you here.
Thank you very much, Senator Anderson. Senator Wiley.
Well, I join with you, Mr. Chairman, saying thanks to these men for a wonderful, let us say, sense of courage and poise that they've demonstrated. I have just one or two questions. When you were up there this last time, Colonel, what were your thoughts really in relation to your faith?
Well, I have some very definite feelings on that, Senator. I can't say that that while in orbit you sit there and pray or anything like that. It's a very busy time, and I know I've tried to have, there have been people in the past have tried to put words in my mouth at a certain time I suddenly lapsed into a prayerful state or something like that, and this just isn't the case. I feel we should live all of our lives every day as though that was going to be the last day. Now, I fall so far short of this every day that it's pitiful, but we come back and keep trying the next day anyway. But I feel that, to me at least, my religion is not a fire engine type religion. It's not something that I call on in an emergency and then put God back in the woodwork in his place at the end of a particularly stressful period. We try to live every day as best we can, and I think that's the way the I would say the same thing happened on the mission. My peace has been made with my Maker for a number of years, and so I have no particular worries about the future along that line.
Well, from what you've said, and we read... from what you've said on other occasions, I was wondering whether you felt that God was up there as well as down here, and that in him you lived and moved and had your being.
Absolutely. I think to try and limit God to one particular section of space or something is a very foolish thing to do. I don't know the nature of God any more than anyone else, nor would I claim to, because I've happened to have made a space ride that got just a little bit above the atmosphere. God is certainly bigger than that, and I think he'll be wherever we go.
Now, what do you see in the immediate future as to improvement in the mechanism?
Well, I think the projects being outlined here by Mr. Webb and other NASA officials pretty well define what we see as the future mechanisms. Immediately, we're looking forward, of course, to 18 orbit missions with an improved version of our present capsule. The next step beyond that will be the Gemini that Al mentioned, and extended missions with that. The whole project that Mr. Webb will be outlining is the project as we see it for equipment.
And more boost would help a lot.
Yes, sir. As Mr. Webb reminds me here, too, more booster power is the crux to the whole thing. As we discussed yesterday before the House committee, we can do anything that the power plants will let us do. This has been the limiting factor, I guess, since man first invented the wheel. He's been power limited, and as we said yesterday, his dreams and his plans always are one jump ahead of his power capability to keep up with the dreams and the plans. So as rapidly as power plants are developed to permit us to use heavier and more elaborate equipment, the more progress we'll make.
Well, do you visualize the improvement in the particular instrument that you had that we've seen between the canoe of the Vikings and the ships of the day?
That's a good size spread that you from the ships of the Vikings to the ships of today, I think would think we're in such a new element that that might be just the beginning, even of some of the progress that we might make to the future.
Senator, I'd say we may be more dealing with a raft at the moment than a canoe, because we just have a vehicle that can exist and from which we can learn the other things we've got to know. We know it doesn't sink, and we know that we can carry our environment with it and live on it. But it's more like a raft, I think.
I won't argue that point. I just wanted to see whether you felt that there was this big opportunity, the big jump that should be made and can be made in order for us to get further acquainted with what's out beyond. You believe in that, do you?
Yes, sir, I certainly do. I think that we're on the eve of an era, or we've made the first little infant step into the beginning of an era, a whole new environment that is so big and so has such a tremendous potential that it's difficult to even describe. So far, we have been limited to observations of our own atmosphere and our own Earth. Now we're getting out into a completely new atmosphere. And the things that we may run into, I don't think we even can envision today. I think the benefits from this are difficult to even try and assess at this point.
Thank you very much, Senator Wiley. Senator Simon.
I'd like to thank Amanda Shepherd for honoring my hometown Saturday, and I'd like to thank all three of you for what you've done for the nation, and above all, what you've done for the youth of America and its beliefs and its faith in the future. In my opinion, one thing that has not been stressed also is what you've done for our position around the world. In my various trips, various parts of the world in recent years, there's been a growing apprehension of the efforts in this field of other people. And I think although this is a tremendous thing to America, it's just as much to the friends of America all over the free world. I want to congratulate all three of you, and Mr. Webb and Mr. Gilroth. Mr. Chairman, I have no questions.
Thank you, Senator Symington. We're now happy to have not only one of the most intelligent, but certainly the most attractive feature of our committee come into this act, Senator Margaret Chase Smith.
Mr. Chairman, I shall not ask any questions at this time, but I would like to suggest that the chairman ask his additional question on my time.
Well, now I'm going to yield back to you, because the first question that Senator Wiley asked Colonel Glenn was the other one I was going to ask.
I shall still pass, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Senator Stennis.
Mr. Chairman, I have just a few questions for Colonel Glenn, and he's already touched on this point with Senator Wiley. Before the joint session, you said that this heralded a new era. Senator Wiley, you called it a new environment. Now, at what place in the development of our air power, the airplane, would be comparable to where we are now with reference to space vehicles? If you could approximate that, certainly we are beyond the Kitty Hawk, North Carolina stage. Are we up to World War I stage? Could you approximate that? And my next question would be, as a nation, do you think it would be just as serious for us to neglect the further development of space vehicles and the mastery of space as it would have been to have neglected air power, we'll say, following World War I?
Senator Stennis, in regard to your first question as to our status of development as compared with air power, of course, this is very difficult to assess.
Yes.
I would say we had just completed the third hop at Kitty Hawk.
Yes.
Right now. We're certainly not beyond that.
Yes.
Point.
Very good. Now, on the second phase of that question, as to the necessity at least, the vital necessity of moving forward toward further mastery of space, do you think it's just as essential and just as fraught with circumstances and disastrous,
yes, sir,
consequences, perhaps, if we fail to, as we would have been?
I think that the program is so worthwhile and has such a tremendous potential for helping us understand the the environment in which we live and for, well, the benefits that we don't even foresee now. It's such a tremendous field when you look at all the different things that can be done and all of the different areas that need investigation and all of the different byproducts that may come from this, that I think this program is worthwhile even if there was no such country as Russia that we're in competition with.
But anyway, it's in this new environment, and it must be developed for many, many different reasons.
Yes, sir.
That's your position.
Yes, sir. This is not just a human experience that we place somebody out here. These are across-the-board scientific advancements in all science fields when we go into this. The byproducts are tremendous.
And a major part of the benefit, too, the byproducts.
Yes, sir.
Is that correct?
A thing that comes to mind immediately is... I noticed an ad in the paper the other day where some company is now advertising for general medical use the little biosensors that we place on our bodies that have been developed during this program. These are such that they can be used while men are moving around or active and can give more reliable pickup than has ever been possible before. So this is just one little example of where in heart research, for instance, maybe one of these little byproducts is falling out of our program right now and will benefit people in heart research. This is just one little example.
I emphasize this because it hadn't been fully understood. There have been efforts to reduce the appropriations for these programs, and I think your counsel and advice to the American people will be very helpful, and I know it'll be much easier now, those of us only committed to support those appropriations. Now, may I say to you, too, that I personally feel that you and your co-workers have been a great medium for revival of spiritual feelings and spiritual things and spiritual values. And also, you personify so well the very best in Americanism. You inspire American youth. You contrast so markedly with all the negative things and the wrong things that we find and are being emphasized. We find in you men a personality that personifies the good things about America and our freedom, our liberty, our achievements. And you can certainly feel that you've made a contribution that way. Now, I'm not going to repeat about this less automation in the vehicle. But just to mention it with great interest as to what you said, because on the Armed Services Committee, we've been concerned about moving toward weapons that didn't have a human being connected with them. The long-range bomber's place, and the next step for the B-70. And now you gentlemen that been baited out even out of space, great advantage to have that human manual control. Mr. Chairman, may I take this one extra half minute to commend Dr. Webb and his staff, and also to commend Dr. Dryden, whom I've known for many years. He used to come before the Armed Services Committee for just a few thousand dollars for some small buildings for the old NACA. NACA. And I was impressed with him then, being such a fine personification of true humility and dedicated public service, except within his limited circle of professional friends, then unknown and partly unnoticed. And it's a great country that has men like Dr. Dryden back to come forward just the right time. Outstanding governmental career.
Thank you, Senator Stennis. I could not be in more complete accord with you, and I am impelled to say that you have so great a portion of the same elements in your own personality that it would be easy for you to recognize them in others and to speak as an authority with reference to them.
Mr. Chairman, could I suggest that you not have Senator Stennis set the precedent of calling me doctor? I'm the administrator and never earned a doctorate. And
I learned a long time ago, Mr. Director, that it is really immaterial what they call you, so long as they call you.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I read the newspapers, and Dr. Webb received a doctor's degree as late as last Saturday night.
Yeah, I understand there was another college that they're building by degrees.
John, are you going to be able to do that? That's John Finney from New York Times.
The senator from New Jersey, Mr. Case.
Mr. Chairman, you're very sparky today, but you always are. It's nice to have you here. We appreciate it. We appreciate it for yourselves and for the rest of your gang and for the whole operation that's behind you. And I just have a couple of questions that I'll ask now, if I may. It relates, Colonel, to the question of the way you stood the trip. We have heard that one of the Soviet astronauts was ill during at least part of that trip that he had. Have you got any idea as to why your experience was different?
No, I don't, to put it in one word. Yeah. However, our experience with zero-G, we were aware of the reports from Mr. Titov's flight. We have no specific information from those flights since they treat their coverage of this in a little different fashion than we do. However, my experience on this was that I had no ill effects from the weightless period at all, at least a period of this length. Now, of course, he went on to a much longer mission than we did, but it was very pleasant. I had no nausea, no tendency toward that at all. We've described, I think, a few times how you can park things in midair and some things like that are very unusual under zero-G. But as far as the body feelings and sensations, it was very, very pleasant. We had no ill effects from it, as have been reported from him at all.
Now, there's some of these things, I suppose, that you can train for, as Captain Grissom was talking about. But I don't suppose you can train yourself to be better able to stand some of these stresses, and that, in relation to those things, it's a matter of selection, isn't it?
We had stressed only one thing in this line, Senator Case, and that is that that we be in as good physical condition as we could be in at the time. We felt if we just prepared us physically as good as we could, that's the best we could do in preparation for zero-G. Zero-G is the one thing that is extremely difficult to simulate here on Earth or in the atmosphere. Now, we have made a number of zero-G flights in airplanes, but you're limited in just going up and pushing over into a weightless parabola that permits only at the maximum about 1 minute of simulated weightless flying. So that isn't very long to try and acclimate to this new element. I found that this was the easiest thing to adapt to that I've run into yet. There was no problem with overreaching switches or there was no tendency to nausea, at least for this length flight. It was a very pleasant experience. Plus, any of us that have a weight problem, if you got on the scales at that time, no problem at all.
Thank you very much. Yes?
If I could add just a few words to what John just said, we have several theories as to what might have caused the Russians difficulties, and these theories were pretty thoroughly investigated before we went up. Primarily, they had to do with the sensations and the mechanisms of the inner ear, and this feeling is related to spacecraft rotational velocities. These things that John investigated to a small degree during his flight, and of course we will investigate to a greater degree during subsequent flights. So the problem has not been ignored. We have theories, I think, which will enable us to investigate it at a moderate pace.
Good. Well, excuse me, go ahead, Colonel.
I had one word to Al's comment here. I probably should have elaborated on that a little bit more. We have been in various devices and machines that calibrated our tolerance to these various feelings. We've set up rotating rooms down at Pensacola and different devices at exact rates to permit us to calibrate ourselves as to where we pick up various sensations, where we can sense certain movements, and how much after effect we get from it. And we have a complete rundown on our own capabilities in this regard, so that if we had run into trouble, we would know at about what rates they had occurred under 1G. We possibly could make some correlation to 0G. So this is, to back up what Al said, 100%. We haven't ignored this or just hoped that the problem would go away. We were prepared to investigate it very thoroughly.
I'm sure that hadn't been ignored. The general point of my question was, I think, the same as that which Senator Anderson was getting at, that is, looking ahead. Are you an extraordinary bunch? And you are, of course. But just from the purely physical side, these things are the capacity to meet the stresses and strains that your body meets are not likely to be limited to just one out of a million. Is that your general judgment? That is, the capacity of the human body of the average person is likely to be able to meet this sort of thing.
Well, anyone going into space will have to have special training, I think. We want to, in other words, the day when you can just go down and buy your ticket and climb aboard and get a safe passage for anyone in any physical condition won't be here for some time. We want to have crews trained so that they can take over in case of any emergency. This would require the highest physical conditioning to be able to do this, just as it does for some of the more hazardous test flying. If you want to have the maximum safety, you want yourself to be in the best physical condition, and I think this will go on into the future as we see it, at least the immediate future in space flight.
I'm sure that's so, but again, not to belabor a point, the capacity to meet these things, assuming proper training, is not something that's to be found only in maybe one out of a million people, is that right?
Oh, not at all, no. We have, certainly, if we wanted to get into greater numbers of flights, we would have no problem at all finding sufficient people to train for this. We're not that superhuman at all.
Well, I hesitate to ask the question because there was some implication that I thought that you thought you were, and I don't. This is only one of many qualities that have produced this extraordinary result. And,
I think you'll find all of our group of seven are pretty much down-to-earth people that have the same physical qualities and the same daily activities as many people do. Many people in differing lines of work, and in particular those who are in military test flying.
Well, Mr. Chairman, this is what I would like to believe more and more about this country, and it's encouraging to have you say it. I have no further question at this time. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Senator Case. Senator from Ohio, Mr. Young.
May I tell you, Colonel Glenn, that on the day of your great achievement, and this morning since 10 o'clock, there has really never been a time in a rather long life that I've been more proud of the fact that, like you, I was born and reared in Ohio. Yes, and you, sir, demonstrated to all the world, you and your associates, the best that an open society and freedom can display before the entire world. And by what you and your co-workers have done, I feel, and I know all of us feel, that never was the prestige of the United States of America higher in the world than at the present time. Now, there's really no question, but I'm somewhat curious, sir. During all of the time, was there ever some moments that there was an extraordinary occurrence or something that had not been envisioned nor anticipated by you in your training that should have caused, perhaps not in a brave man like you, but should have caused a feeling of apprehension, something unexpected? Did anything like that occur during your flight, sir?
Yes. There was the occurrence during the re-entry when we had kept the retro package on because of a false indication we have since found. Al had called me from the capsule communicator's position and had recommended, after consultation with practically everyone in sight at the Cape and long distance back to St. Louis, to the McDonald plant, and with all the experts on all of these various systems, had recommended that we keep the retro package in place during reentry. Now, this is something that we had considered as a possibility. We never have run tests on previous flights, but there had been wind tunnel tests conducted to see what would happen if this was ever necessary. At the beginning of reentry, one of the straps that holds the retro package in place had burned loose, and I could see it. It was up around the side of the capsule, and I could see it from the window. So I knew for sure that the retro package had been released. At the time it released, I felt a bump back on the capsule and thought that the retro package had come off and had been jettisoned, as it was supposed to do. Apparently, it was still in place back there, even though the straps had broken, had come loose. So that during reentry, instead of just having the heat shield back there, which I thought I had, I also had the retro package still sitting on the heat shield. Well, during reentry, when you get up to the high heat conditions during reentry, this retro package then started to tear up and was flaming. Pieces of it came back around the capsule, and these could be seen through the window. At that time, of course, I thought the retro package had been long gone, so I wasn't certain at that time whether it was the heat shield coming apart or not. I couldn't imagine that it was the heat shield. We never have had any indication of them tearing up like that. But on the other hand, I thought perhaps something had occurred by keeping the retro package on there that had damaged the heat shield earlier. So with these chunks coming off and coming back around the capsule, this was a moment of some concern, because you have to have that heat shield for reentry. If you don't, well, you would burn up.
Thank you, Colonel. Yes, sir. No further
questions. Thank you, Senator Young. Was that the part of your experience that caused you to refer to the capsule or the trip as being a fireball or something of that kind?
Well, Mr. Chairman, during the reentry, as the heat shield operates back here, the surface ablates away. It goes into sort of a steam almost and absorbs heat. As this heated material then ablates away from the shield and comes up around the capsule, it's still very hot, it's glowing, and you can look out the window and you can see you're actually in the middle of a fireball during reentry, and you can see this out the window. It's an orange glow, and when I made the remark, I guess, about the man, what a fireball, or something to that effect, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Senator Cannon.
I want to join with the others here in congratulating you, Colonel Glenn, and the complete entire team, the astronauts, the director of the program, and the thousands of people who worked on this project to make it a success and help get America back in the position that they should be in the world, and I believe that they are today. In that connection, I think one of our great military leaders made a very good observation to me yesterday when he said that he was extremely happy to see that the idol and hero of the American teenager and youth today had changed from the rock and roller to Colonel John Glenn, and I think that's extremely important. In that connection, I would like to direct a question to Captain Grissom, who explained the importance of this training program, and I would like, if you would, sir, to emphasize the importance of physical fitness of anyone who intends to operate in this type of a program, because I think that it's important for the public to know, if it is a fact, that you men, at the time you started your training program, perhaps were not in the physical condition to carry out the program successfully.
Well, being in the military, and especially in test flying, I think that all of us probably were in better physical condition than other men of our age throughout the country. But we have found that it is necessary to stay in good physical condition to just undergo the training program, let alone the flight. And by being in good shape, we feel that we're ready for any emergency or any contingency that should occur. And we do feel it's very important. We don't have a formalized physical training program. Each of us goes at our own pace and just makes certain that each of us stays in condition.
When Now, Colonel Glenn stated that it was extremely important as a prerequisite for anyone desiring to get into this overall program that they have a basic good general education. Would you say also that it is an important prerequisite that they maintain themselves in good physical condition?
Yes, I think this is important to all the youth of our country to maintain themselves in good physical condition. And I'd like to say something else about the basic education that John talked about. I've always had the feeling that, and I've told all the young people that have written to me, that I think they should follow their own interests, and this keeps them happier, they do a better job, and then it's up to us to lead them a little bit and make sure their interests are where they should be.
Thank you, Captain Grissom. Colonel Glenn, with further reference to your prerequisite of a basic good general education, as we know, there were thousands of scientists and scientific and engineering trained personnel working on this program, and I wonder if you'd care to comment on the importance to a program of this nature of the specialized, specially trained personnel in the scientific and engineering field.
Yes, sir, Senator. I would like to comment on that very much. Without such people, there wouldn't be any program such as this. We have been receiving, the three of us here and the other fellows that were here the other day, have been receiving all the acclaim, of course, for all of the effort that has gone into this program. And this, actually, we are more figureheads than anything else. We're not trying to underplay the fact that we are the people in the capsule, and we have our neck out, of course, where the other people don't. We don't deny that at all. But beyond that point, we're mere figureheads. We're representatives for a tremendous pyramid of technical, scientific work that is hard to believe until you're actually involved in the program. We are really the representatives for all those people during all this acclaim, and that's actually the way we feel about it. We're not just paying lip service to that. It's a big, hard-working team all together, and it has been that way all the way through.
Now, Colonel, you said that one of the most important things you discovered was that man could satisfactorily operate in space, and you also pointed out that this particular shot might have failed had it not been for a man being aboard because of the failure of some of the systems. As you know, there has been a considerable argument going on as to whether or not man can better perform missions in space and outer space than a machine. Would it be fair to assume, from your experience here, that we are not at a technical stage today where man can satisfactorily be replaced in space or in the atmosphere for the performance of missions by machines in our present state of technological development?
Well, I feel, sir, that we're already at the point where we can gain far more from the experiments we want to carry out by having a man aboard. Now, early in the program, if we could get as much probably at one time on a certain early experiment by making just an instrumented machine and sending it up and back. But we're looking forward not only to... We're looking forward to the time when we will have power sufficient to go out and actually stay in space for extended periods of time, make extended observations, conduct scientific experiments that will be fairly complicated. We may, if we have power sufficient at that time, of course, we'll want to maybe change course, drive around in your spacecraft as you do now in an airplane, for instance, and go where you want to go to do and see and make the observations that are best to be made. Looking forward to that time when where an intelligent human being in space is mandatory. There are some things like that that we can never foresee doing with machines. Looking forward to that time where we're no longer as power limited as we are now. At that time, we can go out into space and with a man aboard, can make tremendous advancements, where if you have to program all this in advance and send it out on a specific mission and back, you have no flexibility at all. I think we're at the point now where we can foresee in the future power plants that will enable us to do a lot of these things. Perhaps some of the other fellows would like to make comment on that.
Commander?
Yes, if I might, I would like to add a few words to what John has just said. I think that you cannot categorically say that man should be in every space vehicle. Obviously, there are conditions where you want to find, you're investigating a specific area, for example, radiation belts, or you're investigating a particular communications phenomena as is being discussed in committee at this time, as I understand, where decisions with regard to what you want can be made on the ground ahead of time. I think in these areas that machines or electronic devices do far better than the man does. However, the human is a computer, really. And if you train the human properly, then the computer can work more effectively per pound than any mechanical computer that we have. A man's decision-making process is obviously slower, but it's a fairly reliable thing under the proper conditions of training. So I would like to add these remarks to what John has said.
And I might carry that one step further. I've heard that carried on in the past to saying he can be produced so cheaply and easily.
And I suppose as pilots, all three of you would agree that the days of the pilot then are not completely over today.
Yes, sir.
Amen. One final question. I believe, Colonel Glenn, that you sustained less G-forces on reentry than Commander Shepard. Was that because of the angle of reentry?
Yes, sir, it was. The angle of reentry is completely different on the two type missions. On the Friendship 7 flight, we come back in at about 1.8 degree angle to the atmosphere. On the earlier flights, on the Redstones, these re-enter the atmosphere at a much steeper angle, take their G-pulse in a much more concentrated period. The Gs are up at a higher peak, but they're for a shorter period of time. On mine, it was a lower peak, about 8 Gs, but it's extended over a longer period of time. So they're different trajectories.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Senator Cannon. I would like to observe that his questions with reference to the requirements for and use of and desirability of pilots and our continuing to need them and respect them not necessarily was directed solely to the position of the witnesses. If I'm not mistaken, the senator from Nevada is himself a very high-ranking officer in the Air Force Reserve and has quite a distinguished record as a pilot. I believe is a maybe even a test pilot for jet aircraft. I'm sure that they're members of the Senate and the House who would hope that these witnesses would confine their activities for the foreseeable future to those directly connected with their profession, rather than following the example of the great pilot from Nevada who permitted himself to be detoured or diverted into politics.
I thank the chairman for overstating the case.
The senator from Florida, Mr. Holland.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, the people of my state are humbly proud that for reasons not having to do with them at all, largely depending upon the geography of the state and the climate of the state, that we're the host state for much of this activity. We would like to think, however, that as human beings, we have made the maximum contribution that is possible by way of consideration and helpfulness and cooperation. With that in view, I want to ask these gentlemen if they have any suggestions. And I want them to be very frank. The people of my state would want them to be. People of Canaveral, Pensacola, Key West, other spots which have participated. Have you any suggestions as to how our people might be more helpful, more cooperative, more active in their assistance as the host areas in which this activity is carried on? First, Colonel Glenn.
don't you think?
Gus? No, sir, none that I can think of, sir. We've always been treated in a very fine fashion in the Cape Canaveral area, where we have done most of our work in Florida, of course. We have been over at Pensacola a number of times. It's always a pleasure to work in Florida. The weather's very nice there this time of year, Senator.
Well, I meant what I said. Our people would want me to make it clear that they would like to make contributions which would be the maximum ones possible from the host areas. Now, I want to ask you one more question, Colonel, which is asked because of some letters I've had and some comments. I think that there's a misapprehension abroad on the part of many of our people that manual controls permit the space traveler to go as he wishes while he's in space, whereas my understanding is, and I think this is a fact, that the orbit is fixed and that the manual controls until time of reentry comes can only have to do with the posture or presentation of the capsule. Is that correct?
That's correct. You have stated it properly. Once we're fixed in orbit, then that trajectory, that orbital path remains the same. Now, we have attitude control within the capsule, along this trajectory. We can control the direction that the capsule is headed. We don't have power sufficient aboard the capsule to actually alter its flight path. We just can control the direction it's headed. Now, when I speak of maneuvering in the future in space, we certainly hope that we can eventually have power plants that will enable us to do both, to not only maintain attitude control as we do now, but also have power sufficient, which incidentally requires tremendously increased power over that required just for attitude control, of course, to go ahead and actually change orbit or to leave one orbit, go to another orbit around the moon, back again. I think eventually we'll come to the day when this is possible. This is the time we're looking forward to when man will really take his real rightful place in space.
You hope, then, for the time to come when the man inside can direct the course, the
yes,
orbit
sir.
In which the capsule will travel.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Now, Mr. Chairman, before we conclude, could I say that I have a friend at the press table who has suggested that Colonel Glenn say a word about what the stars really look like, that this, as introduced by Alan Shepard, is a real new element. I'm not sure much can be said.
I'd like, if we wait just 1 minute, then we will do that. Senator Magnuson, a distinguished member of this committee, could not be here. He was very anxious to have two questions asked. He asked Senator Pastore, chairman of the Subcommittee of Communications of the Commerce Committee, to be here. Would you ask those two questions for Senator Magnuson and Senator Pastore?
Yes, I'd be very glad to. First, let me say that I consider this a privilege to be here on this occasion, and I join with my colleagues in the very fine tribute and deserved tribute that they've paid to these three excellent Americans. Now, the question is this, and then I have one question of my own, which I hope that the chairman will indulge me in asking. But Mr. Magnuson's question is this. Are there any plans to make your experience available to the Air Force and its industrial contractors to improve the design of the cockpit and the spacecraft in the Dinosaur and other military space programs? I don't know whether that's a question to Mr. Glenn, but...
I think perhaps I should defer that question to Gus Grissom here, since he's already been out doing some of that liaison work.
Well, I think John has actually already answered the question. Everything we have done is available to the Air Force or any of the other contractors that should desire it. We have been working with them to a limited extent, at least, on their cockpit mock-up. And we hope to continue this in the future. And we also hope that the Dinosaur pilots and the Dinosaur people will participate some in our program so that there is some exchange of ideas and improve both programs.
And now, Mr. Chairman, may I ask one question on my own? Some reference has been made here this morning that we're living in an open society. I recall that in much of our activity of the past, there's been some criticism on the part of very few, fortunately very few, that we always operate in the open. We have the habit of telling all. Now, in this particular instance, the entire world was given the opportunity to see you, Mr. Glenn, go up and to come down. In that way, of course, we dramatize our failures as well as we dramatize sometimes our successes. Is this a good way of doing it?
Well, I say quite frankly that there were those of us when the program started, when this was decided that we were going to have complete coverage at the Cape, that we heard this with some misgiving. We felt at that time with no flights behind us, and the Russians had had a successful flight at that time, that perhaps this was not wise for the exact reason you stated. It would dramatize our failure and make us look even worse before the world at that time. The decision was made that we would go ahead in an open, with open presentation of all the flights, open to the news media of the world. This obviously was a wise decision, I think, looking back on it now. It has placed us in our traditionally American position of being open, free, and honest with all the countries around the world, where otherwise we might have been criticized for holding back and for looking like some other societies have done, where they have closed doors on such things as this. This points up another thing, though, that we talked about some yesterday among ourselves, and that was at, well, and in the open, too, yesterday. That is that we may have failures sometime in the future. We're sort of riding a crest of enthusiasm here at the moment, but as in aviation, there will be failures sometime. And we're not looking forward to these. We're certainly not planning on them, but being realistic, we know they will occur. Anytime you have this type of motion, this much machinery, and these kinds of speeds involved, sometime there will be failures. We hope that the confidence and the kind of feeling we share in, or we have in this program and in its tremendous future, that the enthusiasm will not be dimmed for the final objectives we're after at that time.
Thank you very much, Colonel. And now, Mr. Webb.
Before suggesting Colonel Glenn speak about how the stars really looked, since this is the first look an American has had at them from outer space, I'd like to comment on the question asked about cooperation with our military services. We have a very complete system of cooperation, not only for the astronauts who give their specific flight experience and work on such matters as have been mentioned, namely cockpit design and other such matters, but we have a very complete system of exchange. This is a national space program. Our launch vehicles are built and operated under a national launch vehicle program. When we come to build a two-man spacecraft, the Gemini, it is entirely possible that the military services may have some need for this. And in the Dinosaur program, in which they are very much interested, we have a very close cooperation. And in many areas, such as the flights of the X-15, we gain common experience by common operations. Some of our men and some of the Air Force men work with the X-15. Some of our pilots fly a mission. Some of their pilots fly a mission. But the United States has the benefit of the total of this knowledge for all the agencies that need it. Now, as to the stars, if you can say anything, John?
Comment on the question regarding the stars. I was rather surprised that you could not see more stars, even on the night side, as well as the day side that the question was addressed to. I think the it's more like being out on the desert in a very clear, dark summer night, when you can look up and the stars just seem to jump right out at you. They're very, very bright. I think they look very much like that, and did not could not see them in any increased quantities particularly. Probably a lot of this is due to the fact that the particular window we have on the spacecraft cuts down the light in about the same quantity as the atmosphere that we normally look through on a summer night. So this means that even in space, with the window we have right now, we won't see too much more in the way of the stars. Now, the light was very steady. It didn't blink on and off. You didn't see twinkling of the stars. It appeared to be a very steady light. On the day side, which is what the question was addressed to, you could not see stars as long as you had the cap. I could not see stars as long as I had the capsule down in the attitude where I was looking out the window toward the horizon, then glancing from that up to the dark areas of space. I could not immediately see stars. However, if I would come up with the small end of the capsule up above the horizon and night adapt my eyes for a minute or so, then I could begin to see the stronger stars, the higher magnitude stars coming visible. We had planned to make a number of observations on the last two orbits along this line. Since we had some small control system difficulties, I was concentrating mainly on those during the last two orbit and didn't really get some of these observations off that we would have liked to have made. I hope that answers the question.
Could you indulge us about two more minutes, Mr. Webb?
Yes, sir.
The senator from Missouri, who very graciously a while ago waived his time, has a question or two he'd like to ask.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Colonel Glenn, first, I'm impressed by the fact you say there may be problems in the future. As the great flyer you are, you know that's true. And this brings me to this question of illness. It might be possible, might it not, that the human body would be affected by a longer flight than the one that you made?
Yes, sir, very much. We're only basing our statements today on our flight experience up to date. That has been about 4 hours and 50-some minutes, and that longer flights might well give some effects that we now don't even see.
And that might be one of the reasons why, as we overcome rapidly the lead of the Russians, which, as the President mentioned, we were planning to do, that might be one of the reasons why the Russian got ill, might it not?
It could be. That would be possible, of course.
One other question to you, sir, and then I'd like to ask Director Webb a question. What plans are we making now, or are we planning to overcome possible problems incident to radiation of the Van Allen belt if we move on out towards the moon?
That's a difficult one, and one that I'm not, I probably should not comment on because I haven't really studied this thoroughly enough with the proper people. I think Al has been talking more to them recently about this. I've been pretty well tied up the last few months, as you can imagine. Well,
he's the one that got me interested in the problem.
All right. Would you care to comment on that, Al?
We said a great many things on the airplane the other day, and I'm not sure I covered this point. And the reason I asked to make a few comments was because I had the opportunity to be in on the design stage of Apollo, that is, in our basic letter to the contractor. I will say only generally that Apollo is the first program during which we expect to encounter higher levels of radiation, specifically the Van Allen belt. And plans here are made for radiation protection within the structure of the command vehicle, that is the vehicle which houses the crew, so that we will have some integral protection. And then during periods of passage through the Van Allen belt, at which time we feel radiation levels will be inordinately higher, then some type of equipment which can be donned for that purpose will be provided. A suit, bulletproof vest type of thing, maybe, will be provided for use during these periods and can be taken off to provide more mobility at other periods during the flight. That's the general plan.
Thank you. And, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to say I inadvertently omitted the high praise that is so well due Dr. Dryden, along an old friend. I'd like to associate myself with the remarks made by my senior colleague, Senator Stennis. Mr. Webb, I'd like to ask you this question, if I may. You have held many high offices in the government. You've been Undersecretary of the Treasury. You've been Director of the Bureau of the Budget. You've been Undersecretary of State. You've been the most successful businessman. You know the importance of eliminating waste in private operations and in government operations. And with that background, do you feel that you have drained all possible waste and all water out of the great new appropriation request that you're coming before this committee to ask for, as I understand it, quite soon? I thought this would be a good time to get you on the record on this.
That's a little bit like asking you if you stop beating your wife. Actually, these programs have to be carried forward very rapidly. The policy announced by the president was not to carry them on as crash programs involving some of the kind of waste that I believe you have in mind, but they are very rapidly paced programs. Now, as we have studied the capacity we have to extrapolate the knowledge we have and the technology we have to make the lunar landing and develop the Apollo system, which includes the boosters and the rendezvous technique, we know that there are certain expectations we have which will not be realized. At that time, we have to make a substitution of a new way around the obstacle. At that time, we may start one or two or three possible developments on a specific item so that the whole project can go forward without delay. I do not regard that as waste. I think I could say that in this whole team effort, which includes not only the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, but all of the armed services, particularly the wonderful support we've had from the Navy in our recovery operations and the great support we've had from other nations in these tracking and data acquisition stations, I should say that I've never seen a project as large as this carried on more effectively with more able men and women involved in it. And I think the greatest assurance you can have that you'll get your money's worth is in the opportunities in this great new aerospace, plus the quality of the men and women. And I'd like to just add one thing. Dr. Dryden and I have given a great deal of care and attention to how we organize this, bearing in mind that the president has announced the policy we must use the resources of the country where they are and not duplicate them. Whatever resources in the Atomic Energy Commission or the Armed Services or other areas we are to use. Now, bearing that policy in mind, I should say we've got a very effective form of organization with four program managers handling the budget and being directly personally responsible for the effectiveness of their program using resources wherever they may be. I think the form of organization, the quality of the people, and the opportunities ahead will make this one of the best investments the United States has ever made.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Dr. Dryden reminds me, mentioned Air Force cooperation. This has been also outstanding. As you know, in the rendezvous technique, the Air Force is just as interested from the military standpoint as we are from the standpoint of the lunar approach. We are working closely and intimately on this. When we look for an engine in space to rendezvous with, it'll be an engine that the Air Force put up. And so we will have the closest association and will share commonly in the knowledge that is gained from this.
Thank you very much, Mr. Webb, and the special thanks of our committee to you and Dr. Dryden and Mr. Gilruth and Colonel Glenn and Captain Grissom and Commander Shepherd. I wonder if the audience will remain seated until these gentlemen have retired. I must acknowledge the fact that our distinguished colleague from New York, Senator Keating, is with us from North Carolina. Senator Everett Jordan, and I believe I see the distinguished senator from Kentucky, Mr. Cooper. Now, if the audience will remain seated until the astronauts and Mr. Webb have retired, then the committee will go back into session on the communications satellite bill, and Dr. Engstrom will return to the witness stand for questioning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, sir.